This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The faces and personalities that make up local fraternities and sororities on our region's college campuses may look different these days. Though Greek life is defined by participation based on gender and their traditional roles and expectations, more LGBTQ students are finding homes and leadership roles within them. We speak with two such students coming up. But first, colleges, universities, and the courts are cracking down on hazing within Greek organizations on campus. We're going to take a look at some of these sweeping changes. Joining Cincinnati Edition in the studio is Miami University Student Activities and Cliff Alexander, Officer of Fraternity and Sorority Life, Division of Student Life Director, Jenny Levering. Welcome, Jenny. And on the phone is author and journalist Alexandra Robbins. Her latest book is Fraternity, an inside look at a year of college boys becoming men. Welcome, Alexandra.
Thank you for having me.
If you've got questions or comments for the show today or our participants, 513-419-7100 will get you on. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and also your tweets. Jenny, I want to start with you. Miami University is known as the mother of fraternities, Beta Theta Pi, Phi Delta Theta, Sigma Chi fraternities, all founded there in the 1800s. Later on, Delta Zeta Sorority, Phi Kappa Tau fraternity founded in Oxford. But the campus has had some issues in recent years. But let's start with the history. Why do so many Greek organizations trace their roots to Miami?
The five groups that started here that you just named are known as the mother of fraternities and sororities, and are known as, three of them are known as the Miami Triad because they were founded here in Oxford, Ohio. So they trace their roots back because they have over 150 years of tradition, history, brotherhood that started all on our campus.
Yeah. So what was the origin of that? Like, is there a sort of story from the past where somebody decided this is a good idea?
They started as literary societies. So they started as academic focused ways for men to connect outside of the classroom, to study, to find brotherhood, to find camaraderie, to find belonging.
So what does Greek life look like on campus in Oxford now?
So fast forward 180 years, the students are still joining for some of the same reasons. How it has turned very social to some organizations, they're still joining for that sense of belonging. They're joining because they want to get involved outside the classroom. They're joining because they want to find a way to connect with others. Miami and many campuses across the country are huge schools. And so when you're coming out of high school, you're looking for that shared bond, that shared connection with other people similar to you, like-minded values, like-minded interests. And that's why we're finding students join. They also want to be a part of something bigger than themselves, that networking, that multiple-year tradition that my father was in it, my grandfather was in it. I want to connect with somebody to find a job. So for all those reasons and more.
Yeah, it's really a lifelong experience as well. So beyond the college years, you are connected to these folks for a long time.
Yes.
Last year, Miami suspended fraternity activity for a period after allegations of hazing. Rush was shut down, chapter activities were stopped. What prompted that? Can you give us the backstory on that?
You know, we, just like many campuses, have safety as our number one concern. And if we get a number of reports during a short period of time and have a general understanding that the health and safety is at risk, and that these organizations are not grounded in their values, we have a duty to protect the system. And so what we did last year was we had a number of reports and we said, just stop the new member programs. We're going to investigate everything and try to get to the bottom of it. And what that period did was it really made us turn in and focus on the great chapters we have and the chapters that want to sustain and the chapters that want to be a part of a growing and a more developmental experience for the students. And it gave the chapters who don't want to follow the rules anymore an opportunity to go.
Okay. And some of the, I guess, aftermath, some of the things that you came up with as a university include starting this semester, spring semester 2019, fraternities will need to have new members complete online training courses on leadership and accountability. What's the makeup of those courses?
You know, we actually launched those, the first two volumes of those courses 3 years ago, an entry level, why join, what are the values of the organizations, how to join, what types of organizations we have, how to navigate a very large system. And then this second phase or this second module is really about being a leader and stepping up. If used correctly, the fraternity and sorority system is an amazing way to gain leadership skills. And we want students exposed to that right when they join. If they don't hear it during the recruitment process, they're going to hear it as a part of this course. We believe the Greek students on our campus should be the leaders, and there's leadership capabilities for all of them in all of our organizations. So it has a leadership focus. It's on values. It's on ritual. It's on virtues and ethics, and just teaching those different concepts to the students as soon as they join.
We're going to come back to some of these other additions that you've made as part of the requirements for joining fraternities at Miami University just ahead. But I want to bring Alexandra into the conversation. Thanks for your patience. In your book, Fraternity, An Inside Look at a Year of College Boys Becoming Men, you followed two fraternity brothers and interviewed hundreds more. Now, you didn't identify anyone or any of the institutions or the Greek organizations, but just tell us what you found in general as part of that culture.
Yeah, that's right. I followed two fraternity brothers for a year. One was a college freshman who was just starting the process of Rush when his story began, and the other was a college chapter president who was trying to make sure his fraternity stayed on the right path. What I found is that it's so easy for the public to demonize fraternities because of what we see in the headlines, but there are actually hundreds of thousands of good boys in the system who face stigma because they are members of these all-male organizations that receive such negative attention in the media. So I wanted to get the message across in a way that's sort of fun to read for both parents and students and also educators, for people to sort of read together and understand, oh, okay, like there are two paths to take. And it's not actually that hard to take the good, low-risk path. And these are the things that parents and students have to know and have to watch for and can see in the stories of Jake and Oliver, these boys whom I followed, what kind of conversations they should be having at home and ways that they can keep themselves or their kids safer and healthier at college while also participating in an experience that can be beneficial.
What was the origin of your interest in pursuing this?
Oh, many lifetimes ago, I did a book about sororities. And after I was giving, whenever I would give lectures at schools, or people would talk about the book, or sometimes schools read my book as in class, they would ask me, well, what about fraternities? And I didn't think it was the right time. I didn't know what new things there were to say. And then once masculinity started being a focus in the news a few years ago, that's when I started to think that this is something that we talk about, but we never talk about how college guys are feeling about masculinity. And college guys are the ones who are right in the center of learning what it means to be a man. That's the time, late adolescence, and we're not really focusing on them. And what are they thinking? And what is their perspective? So that was sort of the origin of this book. Let's talk to them and get it in and represent their voices, which isn't usually heard.
And your previous book was called Pledged, The Secret Life of Sororities, which explored the female side of the Greek coin. How did you find that sororities and fraternities are similar, outside of just their governance and organization, but in the culture that they create?
Well, students join for the same reasons that were previously mentioned a few minutes ago. They want to join a community that makes a college campus feel a little bit smaller. They want a network, and it's more than social. It's sort of like they both are looking for a surrogate family, and that was the origins of fraternities as well. When fraternities began, college students were so much younger than they are now. Sometimes they would matriculate at the age of 10. So it really helped to have this group of guys who were there in what was then, back then, an austere, sort of strict, regimented program. So to have these guys and feel like, okay, I'm away from home, but I can count on my new friends, my brothers. Even the language is used as second family. And I think that concept has stayed while several other aspects of these organizations have changed.
And Alexandra, did you find anything as it relates to hazing while you were working on your new book?
Yeah, I found many things as it relates to hazing. People don't haze. I'm not defending hazing. It's wrong. It shouldn't exist. I talked to so many guys whose chapters don't haze and whose bonds are as strong as or stronger than the chapters that do haze. But it's not just a sadistic activity meant to humiliate new members. Many members and alums truly believe that if you put a pledge class in a situation where they have to struggle and face adversity together, then they will emerge from that situation as lifelong friends. And because it happened to the alums, then they think, oh, well, that's what we have to put the next group to. And then the next group goes through it. And, you know, it's psychology. It's cognitive dissonance. They say, oh, it was worth it because now we have these lifelong friends. And let's put the next group through it so they can have friendships like ours. It's not always coming from a malicious intent.
And Jenny, is that what you're finding at Miami?
Absolutely. Yep.
What are some of the cases that you have dealt with in terms of hazing in the Greek organizations?
You know, we continue to see varying levels. It's everything from having them wear the same thing to, you know, we have had chapters closed because of forced consumption of alcohol. But a lot of it tends to be, as Alexandra said, not completely malicious, just kind of some of the more silly things to bond groups together.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Local campuses are reforming their approach to fraternities and sororities. We continue our conversation now with Miami University Student Activities and Cliff Alexander, Officer of Fraternity and Sorority Life Division of Student Life, Director Jenny Levering. She's here in the studio. And on the phone is author and journalist Alexandra Robbins. She wrote the book Fraternity and Pledge. Again, thanks for both of you for being here. The number to call in is 513-419-7100. If you'd like to weigh in on this conversation, you can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Alexandra, you told Inside Higher Ed that fraternity members that you spoke with want to change what has been called campus rape culture. What are you seeing in terms of initiatives to see that through?
Yeah, that the guys I talked to, they deplore what's going on, and they do not want to be associated with the chapters that are what students call rapey. So the ones that I talked to are doing things like, for example, I followed Oliver, that's the chapter president, for a year, and his chapter was so vigilant about protecting women and preventing sexual assault. One of the things they did was they always made sure to have an appropriate number of sober monitors at their events. And they had two events per week, two parties a week. So, you know, this isn't a small commitment. The sober monitors were tasked not only with making sure that brothers and partygoers didn't get too drunk, but also it was their responsibility to watch for what Oliver called gray area hookup situations, where if it seemed like a girl was uncomfortable, or if it seemed like a girl and a guy were talking and they were both too drunk, then a brother would step in and distract the girl, maybe go redirect her to another person or bring her to a group of girls or offer her an easy way to get out of the situation, while another brother would go to the guy and say, dude, you know, I don't think this is right. Like, let's go do something else. They intervened whenever they could. There are instances of the book where Oliver himself intervened to prevent these situations. And they had zero sexual assault issues the year that I followed them. And as far as I know, any of the years when these guys were members. So there are things that guys can do. Fraternities can be part of the solution rather than the problem. And I felt that that was a really sort of heartening, optimistic look at these groups.
We got a comment from Danielle. She thinks we're painting too pretty a picture of what she calls frats. And she wants to know of examples of dangerous hazing that either of you have come across. And I guess counting on this silence here, Alexandria, I referenced that Inside Higher Ed article that, or excuse me, this was a Marketplace interview that you gave, and you were asked about whether these fraternities have earned these reputations because of the headlines. And you said that you and a researcher conducted an analysis of negative headlines and yeah, found that it's actually a very low percentage of fraternities that are involved in this. And I wonder if that might be painting Danielle's perception as well. Your comment on that.
Well, yes. What we found was that in the 2010s, there were about 2,000 instances of negative incidents. That could be hazing or racism or sexual harassment, just things that you don't want to see. However, it turned out to be not that high a percentage of fraternities. It's just that that's what we're inundated with in the news. So any callers who want to know, instances of bad behavior in fraternities, pick up a newspaper or Google pretty much any day and you'll see something. But we don't see the good groups. And so I don't mean to paint a too rosy a picture of fraternities overall, because there are some horrific things going on, for sure. However, there are what academics call high-risk fraternities, and there are low-risk fraternities. And while we hear about the high-risk fraternities in the media, we don't hear about the low-risk fraternities, and those are the groups whose sexual assault and drinking statistics are actually no different from the student body at large.
Alexandra, I know we have to let you go in a moment, but before we do, just on your experience and your research that you've done for the two books that you've collected, do you find it to be difficult for these higher ed institutions to manage their Greek organizations?
Well, I think it can be challenging because in many cases, the students aren't sure who has oversight. I remember one time I asked a sorority member, this was a long time ago, but I said, well, what happens when your national sorority rules conflict with university rules? And she says, oh, well, if the national sorority rules conflict with university rules, then the sorority rules win. And that just hit me the wrong, that just struck me as the wrong point of view, because these are students who are on a campus with university administrators who are trained to be university administrators and are trained to manage students, whereas many members of fraternity and sorority leadership don't necessarily have the qualifications to be managing college students. So if students feel the pull, they really should be following university rules while they are under university jurisdiction. So I think it can be difficult for universities to help students understand where their loyalties lie.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We've got Sharon on the line. Sharon, what's your question or comment?
I have lived downhill from two very large fraternity houses since 1996. When these houses have parties, which is actually quite frequently, they use stereo equipment that is used at U.S. Bank Arena. And the reason why I know this is because I worked for Cincinnati Stagehands for several years and am very familiar with the type of equipment they're using. You can't imagine the noise that comes from these speakers. They have no business in a neighborhood. I have tried to get the university.
Sharon, are you talking about University of Cincinnati, Miami?
Yeah.
Okay.
The University of Cincinnati.
Gotcha.
District 5 Police. The University of Cincinnati Police. The Greek Life, the heads of that.
And you're finding that nobody has been able to assist you.
Nobody wants to do anything about this issue.
Okay, well, we'll hang up and get some reaction here from the panel. Thanks for the call, Sharon. Jenny, this is something that you probably have to deal with as the director of that part of student life on campus. She's talking about UC. You're with Miami. But surely you get complaints on occasion just about little nuisances like the noise and the aggravation that causes the neighbors. What do you have to do?
We really try to build, we call it the Good Neighbor Initiative. And we work with our fraternities and the town of Oxford, which is quite a bit smaller than Cincinnati, but to build relationships with one another. So we have fraternities that have community dinners where they invite the neighborhood to dinner a couple times a month. And it just builds relationships with the folks that are living around them. So I would encourage her to reach out to the fraternity directly and say, hey, let's build a relationship. And maybe they'll think twice about the noise at night.
Alexandra, when you were working on your book, Fraternity, what did you find in terms of the lifestyle inside the house? I mean, was this a clean environment? Was it an organized environment? Were there a lot of parties? What was life like at the house?
It depends 100% on the chapter.
Yeah.
You can have two chapters that are completely different and have completely different lifestyles who are right next to each other on Greek Row. So it really runs the gamut. And to Jennifer's point, I agree 100%. One of my favorite chapters that I met during this process is a New Jersey chapter that really goes out of their way to be community contributors. Every fall, they offer to rake leaves for free for any neighborhood residents. Every winter, they're shoveling snow for any neighborhood residents. Also, I would want to know about the noise ordinance in that county. It might be sort of a county council sort of issue for the caller before, in case the fraternity is breaking a noise ordinance.
And that's a good point. And before you go, Alexandra, I just wanted to ask, if you had a student approach you and say, look, I'm thinking about exploring Greek life, what's your advice to them based on your experience?
I would say take your time. Don't necessarily rush as a first semester freshman, because if you want to fall into a healthy group that has guys who want to encourage you to sort of be the best possible person you can be, rather than just a social group that focuses on parties and some of the more superficial elements, you have to get to know them before you rush. So I would say, yes, it's worth exploring, because you never know which group might be for you. And one more quick thing, on many campuses, there's sort of an unspoken, well, it's spoken, but it's unofficial, ranking system where there are top-tier, middle-tier, and bottom-tier houses. They are ranked often by how party hard they are, the money they have, and looks, and how much alcohol they supply. So I would tell students, don't necessarily go for the higher tier houses. Really take a look at all the houses to see which is just a great group of guys.
Alexandra Robbins, she's the author of the new book, Fraternity, An Inside Look at a Year of College Boys Becoming Men. Alexandra, we appreciate you joining our conversation today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll continue now with Jenny Levering from Miami University. She oversees the Greek life on campus as part of her role in the Student Life Department. If you've got any questions, it's 513-419-7100. Email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. I wanted to ask you a question that I'd already asked Alexandra, Jenny. Is it difficult to manage Greek organizations?
You know, we're very lucky at Miami. We have a variety of different support mechanisms so that it doesn't feel like it's our office alone. While we have dedicated staff members that work for the university to help and advise those organizations, we really take a three-pronged approach. And it's us, it's the student leaders who are elected into the position, it's the alumni and the national organization, and it's Miami. And we all work together to support the chapter. Being that we have many groups founded at Miami, we have leveraged that a bit, and we do work with headquarters very, very closely. Whether they are in town or whether they're in Indianapolis or whether they're in Virginia, we're on the phone with them just as frequently as we're meeting with the chapter presidents.
Yeah, a lot of these fraternities and sororities have their national chapters in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, do you know why that is?
I don't know. I should have looked that up.
It just occurred to me that that's kind of strange.
The majority of them are there.
What's the percentage of Greek students on campus?
Right now it's about 30%, and it has been consistently about 30 to 35% over the last 10, 15 years.
Okay, well, let's get back to what we started to talk about a little earlier in the program, and that's some of the reforms that Miami University is undertaking after some situations involving fraternities and sororities either needing to be suspended or stopped on campus. You already talked about how you've changed these new online training courses for leadership and accountability, but the groups are also going to need to complete a new member period in 4 weeks, and that's a reduction in the amount of time that they had to do this. What is that course?
So that's just the new member period. That's what's known as pledging, or the as soon as they get their bid, it's the period between their bid and when they're initiated. And we looked at a variety of different things, but we said if that's the riskiest time period for a student to be a part of one of these organizations, how do we reduce it a bit? And so we landed at 4 weeks as kind of a trial, and we just completed that this past 2 weeks ago. The students got their bids at the end of January, and they were initiated by March 3rd. And we had a lot of success this first year.
Okay, so starting next spring, 2020, all new members of Greek organizations will be required to have a GPA of at least 2.75. That's up from 2.5 to join a fraternity. So what's the motivation there?
There we just looked at how do we realign and assist chapters in realigning back to their core mission of academics. Miami Greek students already have outstanding GPAs. Many fraternities are above the all-men's average at Miami. And so 2.5 was very low for to be the minimum standard to go through recruitment. So we're going to stair-step that up, but the first year it's going to be a 2.75.
And this is a big change because Miami mandates first and second year students to live on campus, but you could get an exemption to live in a fraternity house or a sorority house as a sophomore. That's changing?
You can still get an exemption to live in a fraternity house, and our sororities are all on campus. We don't have sorority properties up in Oxford, but the fraternity exemption is staying. There are just new requirements to gain that exemption.
I wanted to ask you, what type of student do you think best succeeds as a college student while maintaining active participation in a Greek organization?
You know, a student who wants to make the most of it, a student who is self-motivated, a student who wants to say, because of this fraternity experience, I want to do this, this, and this. Somebody who just doesn't join it for a social outlet, somebody who joins it and says, I want to be the president, or I want to be in charge of our service projects, or I want to be in charge of the house management. Many of these fraternities are multi-million dollar operations. And if you get a business major in there who wants to manage the finances, he's getting a great level of experience before he goes on out into the real world.
We got a comment from James. He says, Greek life is archaic and should be put to rest. Students can make their own friends and build their own group support system. What do you think about that? People who believe that these Greek organizations are a relic from the past.
They're old organizations. They are. But they're changing with the times. Many of them are. And they still are very, very popular. They still are a major mechanism for students to get involved on campus. And for as long as they are still offering that, and we are able to provide healthy, good experience for students, then they're gonna grow with higher education.
When a prospective student asks you about whether Greek life is the right choice, how do you answer that?
I say 100% if you do your research. We have everything out on our website, from GPAs to conduct histories to listed profiles of the members and what they're involved in. And it's really easy to do a quick website scan and see which are our top organizations and which would be a very, very good experience for students. And actually, Miami's at a point now where all of our organizations are great. And so I think students should be able to do their research. I wear the student activities and involvement hat. And so if Greek life isn't for a student, we have 700 other student organizations on campus. So there is a place for everyone on our campus if they go through the Greek life experience and they say, this isn't for me.
Thanks to Miami University Student Activities and Cliff Alexander, Officer of Fraternity and Sorority Life, Division of Student Life, Director Jenny Levering, for being here with us today. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, a pair of local students will discuss the growing involvement and influence of LGBTQ students in Greek organizations. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Students who participate in local Greek organizations, fraternities, and sororities are working to make their groups more inclusive. Some LGBTQ members are becoming more influential and owning leadership roles within them. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss that aspect are University of Cincinnati Sigma Alpha Epsilon Pi President Elliot Drasnan. Welcome, Elliot.
Thank you.
And Northern Kentucky University Tau Kappa Epsilon Pi Omicron Chapter President Bo Powers. Welcome, Bo.
Hi.
Okay. The phone number to call in if you've got questions for these two, 513-419-7100. Also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweet. So I want to disclose first that I am a member of Tau Kappa Epsilon and its Pi Omicron chapter. I'm an alumnus there from Northern Kentucky. I pledged way back in 2001. Bo, you're the president of this organization. You're openly gay. And that's a different experience from what I recall 18 years ago. So talk about your experience in being part of a fraternity, identifying as gay.
It never really came about as something that was super important to them. It never came about as something that was super important to them that I had to openly come out and tell them, and they had to either accept or reject me. It was as soon as I was in, I was their brother, I was a part of their friend group. I didn't have to vie for their acceptance or hide who I was, and that was the first time in my life that I didn't have to hide who I really was, and they just accepted me for who I was. And that really spoke a lot about the men that I pledged with and my brothers who I have now.
So were you openly gay in the rush process?
Not in the sense that I would go around telling people that I was, but it wasn't something that I hid. It never seemed like something that I had to not disclose.
Did you know of other gay members in Greek life, and did that weigh on your decision to pursue?
I moved here from 4 hours away, so I knew no one at all in at Northern Kentucky. So I didn't know any openly gay members, openly bi members. I didn't know anyone. But now that I've joined and now that I've met so many people across the Greek community at NKU, I've met so many openly gay, proud people that it's incredible.
Yeah. And so now you're the president of the chapter. So talk about that. I mean, this obviously has not been an issue at all.
No. When I first came in, I set a goal that one day I would be the president. And they just, as long as you put in the work, it doesn't matter who you are or what kind of life you live. Putting in the work is what really matters to them.
Elliot, the University of Cincinnati News Record identified you as the first transgender Greek Life president. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency put it this way earlier this year, quote, "But the 21-year-old's election was surprising in at least one way. For the first time, Sigma Alpha Epsilon Pi would be led by someone not identifying as a woman. About a year earlier, Elliot Drasnan came out to the sorority sisters as non-binary, identifying neither as a man or woman. Drasnan asked to be referred to using they as a singular pronoun instead of she." Okay, Elliot, so tell us about Sigma Alpha Epsilon Pi and that experience.
Yeah, so SAE Pi is a Jewish sorority that started as sort of an extension of AE Pi fraternity in it, as well as the element of being a social group. So I actually am one of the founding mothers of the chapter at UC, meaning that 2 years ago, someone came up to me and said, "Hey, do you want to start a Jewish sorority here on campus?" There wasn't a Jewish sorority at the time. There was a Jewish fraternity. And I said, sure. And one of the really incredible things about that was that I knew after a certain period that I wasn't a woman, and I talked with both the members in my chapter and the national organization to say, you know, am I actually still allowed to be a member if I'm not a woman? And there was never any question about it. It was always, of course, you're always welcome to be here. And that was really empowering for me to know that I was creating a gendered space and I was entering into a gendered space, but I didn't have to be and subscribe to that idea of I have to be a woman to be a member.
So I want to talk about that with both of you then, because it is somewhat gender nonconforming from both of your perspectives, your experiences in terms of tradition, and those spaces in particular, fraternities and sororities, they're designated to empower one gender and the other, right? So you're separated by your gender, and then all of the social desires and social interactions that you wish to have based on your gender are what are explored there mostly from the social aspect of it. So starting with you, Elliot, how do you fit into that part of it when it's just women being women or wanting to do what traditional straight women want to do in that environment?
Well, one of the nice things about our chapter is that it's not very straight. It's really queer.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the members identify in different parts of the LGBT community. But it's we all sort of understand that we're coming at it of a place of, like, we want to make this space for women. And that basically just means you can't identify as a man. You can't be a trans man and come in. You can't be a cis man and come in. But pretty much besides that, you're welcome to be here. And just sort of as a group, we kind of put that together for our own part. And it a part of it was a nice sort of happenstance almost, where I don't think that that's something that can happen in every chapter. And I don't think that's something that does happen in every chapter. It's just sort of the people that we brought together were really open and willing to let that happen and to intentionally make that happen, even though we all agreed, like, yes, we're creating a space for Jewish women, but that women has an asterisk at the end.
So do you think other sororities on campus at UC may struggle with this issue a little bit more than yours?
Yeah. I mean, I don't particularly interact with a lot of the other, like, Panhellenic. Like, we're a part of the Multicultural Greek Council, so I don't end up interacting a ton with the Panhellenic groups. They're all open and accepting, but I don't think to the same extent of they definitely have a more, like, we're creating a women's space and intentionality of being only women.
Okay, and Bo, you know, anytime you see a movie about a fraternity from the 70s, 80s, 90s, or now, it's these are guys who are out looking for girls, and that's not your experience. So you're a gay guy amidst all these other guys. Just what is just socially in terms of friendship interaction? How does that dynamic play for you?
Socially, I get treated just like any other guy would, except whenever they would talk about girls, I would talk about guys. It didn't really change how we talked about things. It was just simply, instead of me talking about girls and how, like, it's typically perceived, I would just be talking about guys, and they were accepting of it, and they would go along with it, and they would joke with me about it, just like they would joke around with each other.
And that's apparently true for multiple chapters at NKU, right? I mean, there is a number of openly gay members of multiple fraternities, as I understand it.
Yeah. NKU is a very, very accepting, inclusive organization when it comes to being open about who you really are and just joining the student organization that you feel most powered towards.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking about growing diversity among the Greek organizations at local college campuses. We're joined in the studio by University of Cincinnati Sigma Alpha Epsilon Pi President Elliot Drasnan and Northern Kentucky University Tau Kappa Epsilon Pi Omicron Chapter President Bo Powers. The number is 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll look for your comments and your tweets there. Why do you think gay students, Bo, should consider joining a fraternity?
Because I don't think necessarily that your sexuality should determine your experience in college. I think that if you find an organization like I have with TEEK, where you are empowered to help organizations like St. Jude's, which that's our national philanthropy. If you are empowered to make other students feel welcome on campus, and you see a path to doing that through Greek life like I did, then you should join. Your sexuality should not determine your experience.
And what about you, Elliot? Why should gender nonconforming or LGBTQ students consider participation in a Greek organization?
I think that it's a little bit different when it comes to gender nonconforming, in that I wouldn't necessarily push very hard for someone. If they wanted to join a traditional Panhellenic sorority, I would say, go ahead and try. See what your experience is. If those people, if those girls there accept and love you and want you to be a part of it, then more power to you. I would find it a lot harder personally to feel more empowered and accepted in a place like that. Whereas if you wanted to join an organization like SAE Pi, I mean, it's from the top down a very much like we are an other as a Jewish org, so we are going to accept the others that might not find that acceptance in those other places. And so we kind of have a different mindset in that, of course, sexuality and gender identity should never stop someone from joining a Greek org, but I can see and perceive those barriers that might stop someone from finding acceptance as someone that's gender nonconforming. Sexuality, I think, is a little bit easier in a space like that where gender identity is a little bit more like it clashes a little bit more with the set ideals of an organization.
Have either of you been a privy to or a victim of, or have you witnessed any homophobia or transphobia on campus?
Me personally, not particularly. The biggest barriers have been outside of campus.
What do you mean?
Like going on trips with my boyfriend places, just still the homophobia that you encounter in everyday life, the looks that you get, people shouting, things that still happen today, but it doesn't happen on campus.
And what about you, Elliot?
I've definitely experienced a greater campus community transphobia where classmates have turned to me and told me that trans people aren't the gender they say they are, that you're the sex that you were born with and that's it. So I've had that experience. In the Greek community, I definitely haven't had that. I mean, when people look at me, they generally see, oh, woman. So they don't think too much behind that of someone as gender nonconforming, which can be good and bad in its own way.
Are either of you involved in other LGBTQ issues on campus, or do you use your role that you have now as sort of your own statement?
I was at one time. I was an LGBTQ ambassador for NKU's Center for Student Inclusiveness, and they had me working on various different things with Greek life, like actually researching which fraternities and sororities on campus would be most inclusive for transgender students during rush. Looking at their national policies and things like that. But after becoming a chapter president, I decided that I should devote my entire time to one organization.
And what about you, Elliot?
I am involved in trying to found the LGBTQ Center Pride Ambassador Program. So that's been a roller coaster to put together, but it's been really fun to particularly try and figure out a mentorship program for younger queer students. And actually, one of the students that I mentored through the program ended up joining my sorority because I got matched with them as because they were questioning their gender and Jewish. And so everyone turned to me and was like, you'll mentor them. And they ended up rushing the sorority, which was really cool. So I'm trying to be involved in other LGBT parts of campus, particularly with the LGBTQ Center.
What type of student do you think Greek organizations best serve in general?
I think that they serve a student who wants to make a change in their community and wants to make a difference. As far as I know, at NKU, the fraternities and sororities put a lot of heavy work into their philanthropies, and they take pride in raising money and supporting those philanthropies. And I think that students who are empowered to make a change are really the ones who are driven towards Greek life today.
And Elliot, what do you think about that? Which type of student do you think is best served by Greek organizations?
I would definitely agree with the philanthropy aspect of it. I think for me too, it's almost a just the student that really wants to find a community and find a place to belong is where Greek life fits in really well, because there are so many different organizations that you can look to and say, like, how could I fit in here? Do I fit in here? And a lot of students can really find their place there. And I think that that's a really important part of it, of just finding a place that you fit in and you belong.
How can these organizations improve the way they do recruitment when it comes to LGBTQ, gender nonconforming people? Elliot?
That's a great question. I don't know that there's necessarily a way to improve recruitment in a way like steps 1, 2, 3. I think it's mostly a genuine commitment and fostering of a culture that is inclusive and saying, like, if you identify in this, this, or this way, come to this and experience it and see if it fits for you. I know for us, it's a lot of trying to find Jewish people around campus, so it's a different version of recruitment. But I think that you really have to, from a top-down perspective, just make sure that there is an understanding of how to think things like safe zone trainings and stuff like that, where people just know, like, this is how you should treat someone in the queer community, and this is how our organization is going to commit to treating everyone that walks in those doors.
Bo, does Talk App Epsilon do anything in particular to let people know that it's a welcoming space for a variety of people?
Nothing like really jumps out of my mind about our rush tactics that we would like go out and openly seek people. Really, the rush process is pretty structured at NKU about, like, where events are, when events are, things like that. But the way that we do try to be more inclusive and bring a diverse group of people in is whenever you meet someone, you have to be friendly. You have to be personable. You have to let them feel comfortable wherever they are, and you have to let them know that they're accepted no matter what they look like, no matter who they might like. You just have to make them feel comfortable and accepted.
What about racial diversity in Greek organizations? Are you seeing an increase in that as well? I know I referenced earlier 18 years ago when I rushed, there were a few openly gay students who were members of the organizations, but the fraternities were mostly segregated. We only had a few African-American students in TEK at that time, but there were historically Black fraternities as well on campus to serve those students. How does that look now?
It looks pretty much the same, but I think that has more to do with the fact that NKU is a predominantly white campus rather than African-American students choosing to join or not to join the Interfraternity Council chapters.
What do you see at the University of Cincinnati, Elliot?
I would agree with that.
And that's a far more diverse campus.
Yeah, it's still... I mean, you can definitely look at those organizations and see a difference and a segregation, I would say. But I think that there's strides, particularly in like places like the Multicultural Greek Council, that are trying to push those boundaries.
Well, thank you, Bo and Elliot, for joining us today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show can be found online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.